With that, I'd actually like to take a moment to introduce our moderator. Her name is Karen Reuter, and Karen is an industrial designer, really. And she comes from a phenomenal experience. She was the worldwide global creative director for Nike for 12 years, and she also owned her own design firm in Munich, Germany. So with that, I'll turn it over to her and let our panelists introduce ourselves. Thank you very much.
So thank you and good morning. I'm really excited to be here, and I'm sort of the last minute fill-in to moderate, but I was part of this panel in Philadelphia, so it was a super exciting panel. And what I want to do is similar to what the moderator did then, is that it gets really exciting and really interesting when we open up the floor to your questions, right? So I'm going to have a couple of questions, but I want you all to take notes and get up to the mics when we open it for questions, because that's when the meaningful and robust conversation starts. So my name is Karen Reuter. I currently live in Boston, where I have my own firm called Cast Collective, and I'm a creative director and brand strategist. Some people call me a brand psychologist. So I think having worked for one of the strongest brands in the world, Nike, for 12 amazing years out in Portland, Oregon, you know, it really teaches you the power of a brand and really understanding who you are and what that means to the connection to the hearts and minds of consumers. So I'm still a passionate Nike representative, but also have my own company now on the East Coast in Boston. I'm going to let Tracy and Randy introduce themselves, and then I'll kick it off with some questions. So Tracy, could you start?
Sure. So my name is Tracy Alensis, and I am the global director for the brand at Xerox Corporation. And as that, like Karen said, part of my role is to create brand advocates throughout the entire corporation. So we have 140,000 employees, and what we want them to do is go off and evangelize the brand, just like you heard Karen doing, whether they're still with the company or not. So all of the brand assets, our brand purpose, our brand promise, all of those things are under my direction, all of our licensing and all of those types of things. But also we run a briefing center in New York City that gives a brand experience. But prior to that, I think I've held nearly every marketing job possible inside of Xerox Corporation, from marketing communications, trade shows, product marketing, channel marketing. So happy to talk about any of those experiences as well. So with that, I'll pass it to Randy.
Thanks. Thank you. It's so great to be here. I'm losing my voice a little bit. I'm sorry. You're catching me in the middle of a 6-week book tour around my two new books. I led marketing at Facebook for 6 years, and I tell a fun story about marketing in the beginning of my book about how my first job was in entry-level marketing at Ogilvy & Mather Agency. All my friends got staffed on glamorous television and magazine campaigns, and I was so bummed when I got staffed on interactive and digital marketing. And 2 years later, it turned out to just be the best blessing in disguise, because then I went on to join my brother in the very early days of Facebook and help grow that company over 6 years. Just 2 weeks ago, I released two books. Dot Complicated is the story of my own very complicated relationship with technology, as I'm sure most of us have a complicated relationship with technology. On one hand, I came to Silicon Valley as an outsider. I wasn't an engineer, and it's interesting coming to Silicon Valley both as a woman and as a non-engineer. Also, I led a lot of really huge projects for Facebook, but at the same time always had the Zuckerberg last name as kind of a bullseye on my back. So I talk a lot about that and the fact that the best thing about tech and the worst thing about tech is the same. It's the fact that we're always connected. So it's wonderful that that I can be on a 6-week book tour and talk to my 2-year-old son through Skype. That's the only reason I'm able to do it. But on the other hand, the fact that we're constantly getting emails and text messages and Facebook messages, like, I don't know how any of us think up the next big, great, innovative idea when we're all distracted all the time. So I've been thinking about that a lot. But I wanted to show you guys Dot, my children's book that I also published, about a young girl who learns to put down her devices and go play outside. And so because I firmly believe that women should toot their own horn, I'll share some exciting news that Dot Complicated was just listed on the New York Times bestseller list and number one Wall Street Journal business book. Thank you. I started literally weeping in the middle of a hair salon when I found out, and they were like, "Why are you crying?" And I was like, "I'm crying because women never get listed on the business bestseller list, and anyone who says women can't write a business book can go suck it. Like, so this is for all the women." So I'm thrilled to be here talking to you guys today.
That's great. So this is so exciting, right? So we have Xerox, we have Facebook, and we have Nike up here, and you know, they touch our lives in so many different ways. So I'm going to ask you both first to comment around, you've both been part of development or transformation of a brand. What was the most important task or aspect in the brand development or in the transformation? What was that moment?
Well, for Xerox, where we're coming from, in a lot of people don't even know it. I've spoken to a few folks. About 3 years ago, we acquired a company that was all about services, business services. And so when you think about Xerox, most people would raise their hand and say, copiers, right? But what we're doing is we're transforming that perception in the marketplace to be about business services. And so what we've had to do is, first thing we had to do was reformulate our purpose. Because if you think about what your purpose is, it's got to be true to what you're doing today, but also where you're going. And so we formulated that purpose, but we also gave a tip of our hat to our legacy. So if you think about Xerox and copiers, for 75 years, those copiers have been simplifying business processes. That's how we started out. It was a patent attorney, actually Chester Carlson, who developed a copier because he didn't want to write patents over and over and over again. He developed a copier, simplifying a business process, right? And so what we did is we just latched onto that and said, okay, we're all about simplifying the way work gets done. That set the stage for our purpose that then we could create this perception-changing brand campaign that now when we have commercials on TV, we stand in front of a copier. We have this beautiful woman. She stands in front of a copier. She goes, "I know what you think when you hear Xerox, right?" And she hits the copier button, and then she brings up a transit map. She goes, "Transit maps." And so we're changing that perception, but by leveraging that legacy. And it's a really tough thing to do, but it seems to be working.
It's so funny to be on a panel together because in the early days of Facebook, we used to say, like, we'll know we've made it when people use words like Facebook and friending like they do Xerox. So it's really exciting. But I think for us, one of the biggest challenges is that Facebook was so successful early on in the college market that it was hard for people to think about Facebook outside of being a college service and a site. In fact, there were a lot of television shows that would, like, refer to Facebook as, like, those college kids eating pizza. And we were like, no, actually, we have, like, 5 million people on the platform. So that, for me, was one of my earliest challenges. And a lot of that was able to change in the 2008 election because Facebook was a huge part of Barack Obama's campaign. And after that, I think people really woke up and saw, wow, this is not just for college kids. This is a site where people are actually meeting and talking about serious topics and changing the world together. What was so interesting is that actually when we expanded to other countries, it was easier. We had a fresh start in other countries. We weren't starting as just a college site. So we actually saw faster growth sometimes in other countries of the world than the U.S. So that was definitely an interesting branding challenge.
So what do you do to make sure that you're connecting to your consumer, right? Because I think that the old days of marketing and being more of a broadcast to being more of a reflection of your core consumer. How are things changing? I mean, Facebook may have approached marketing in that way from the beginning. And then how does Xerox, so really a company with a history, approach that?
So from our perspective, you know, it's still about knowing who your consumer is. So you've got to know your audience, and every audience is going to, you've got to approach them the way that they want to connect with you or the way that they want to engage with you. So we use a variety of media, whether it be broadcast, whether it be social channels. And what we do is we try to make sure that we're using the right form of media and engaging with them how they want to be engaged with. So, for example, on a lot of our sales organizations or our consumers, they don't want to be sold to. They want thought leadership. And so what we do is we leverage our social channels to talk about thought leadership topics and forget about the sales, because that's the last place, the last thing you want to do in a social channel is sell. And so that's kind of how we approach it.
There was a pretty funny story when Facebook first launched the news feed. We had been working on it for a year. We were so excited. And I don't know if anyone was like super early Facebook user, if you can remember like before there was even a news feed, when it was just like your inbox and like you had to go actually go to all your friends' profiles to see what changed. So we, for a year, we worked on this and we were like, people are going to love it. It's so awesome. And we, everyone got to their site the day it launched and all they saw was a big green button that said awesome. And then they clicked it and their entire site experience changed and people did not think that was awesome. Not awesome. And we, like, I learned every back entrance into the office because people were protesting outside the office. And so we learned that day, we're like, oh, I guess we have to like listen and understand our consumers and what they want. We can't just launch products with a big awesome button anymore. But what I think is so great is that a lot of content these days is starting to involve users more and more. So one of the projects that we just did, now that I've started my own production company post-Facebook, we did we worked with Brides Magazine of Condé Nast to do an entirely crowdsourced live-streamed wedding. So every single aspect of the wedding was chosen by viewers. Like the couples sent in their videos, and then it was they chose the dress and the band and the celebrity officiant and literally every aspect of the wedding. And you're starting to get content and marketing programs now that are entirely chosen by your users, so you know they're going to be successful even before they launch.
How do you balance that more innovative approach with the more traditional approach? You know, how do you know when to push the innovation lever or when to bring back to a more traditional?
I'm definitely like really far on one side of the spectrum here, so I don't
know.
It's hard to give a balanced answer to that, because my general thought is like, if someone's already done it, I don't want to do it anymore. But I do think that definitely understanding your consumer, like you're saying, not every brand needs to be on every single hot new startup. Sometimes it's better to give it a few months to sit and wait and see, is this, you know, a really compelling new platform, or is it a fad of the moment? And I also think that it's important if you're a consumer to really understand the demographic and know, you know, what are the three or four websites or things that our consumer is doing? How do we really delight and reach them in a new way?
Yep. And I would concur with that. And I'd also say, you know, one of the things that we do is we know what we want to get out of any type of marketing program. So once we understand that, then we look at what's the right channel to engage at the right time. And so we're trying to make sure that we're leveraging that right channel. Or, for example, if something's new and innovative, it might not be the right thing, or it might not touch our audience. Or if we want to start, we'll play with something, do our homework, make sure we understand it, but then, you know, not go all in, you know, if we're not sure it's going to work. So we kind of test the waters a little bit.
That's right.
And then,
I also think sometimes I'm always wary when people use innovation as just a PR stunt to mask like a product that isn't really embracing tech or embracing change. Like, one example I think is the fashion industry a little bit. Like at New York Fashion Week or other fashion weeks, you always see like really cool tech integrations, right? Models wearing Google Glass walking down the runway, or dresses that light up with tweets on them and all these things. And then at the end of the day, you're left wondering, like, well, are these brands really embracing tech? Like, Chanel doesn't even have a web presence, and a lot, you know. So I think there's definitely a fine line between like being innovative, because that's part of your brand ethos and being innovative just as a PR stunt.
Totally agree.
So I'm going to aim this first at you, and then I'm hoping that Randy will chime in. So being from a traditional company, right, Xerox, what is that role of social media for a company like Xerox today? And, you know, how do you balance that with the more classic marketing tools? So I think it's a challenge we all face, right? So how much, and then where are some of the sort of tried and true, proven and tested methods still good?
Yeah, so we have a very active social media practice at Xerox. So we're trying to do kind of both and. We have to have the traditional methods of marketing, but also the social media. And the reason for that is because if you look at the sales cycle, about 60% of the buying process is done before people even engage you as a company. And so what you've got to do is you've got to be out there in social media engaging, viewed as a thought leader and an innovator way up early in the process. And what we'll do is we'll have various social media channels. So, for example, I used to run our marketing communications in our production business. And there, what we found was the most subscribed to channel or the most subscribed to forum was a blog. And therefore, the first thing we did is we started a blog. And then we expanded from there. So trying to figure out where your best bet is going to be, and then learning, growing, expanding. And then, you know, what the other thing that we're doing is, as I mentioned earlier, we have this services business. And a lot of people don't know us for services, and they don't know that we're in healthcare. So we actually started an entire web presence called Health Biz Decoded. And it's a thought leadership site that talks about all different types of articles on healthcare, but it's only presented by Xerox. It's not got the Xerox logo on it in a big way because, again, you have to be believable. And so we're experimenting with different mechanisms and different ways of leveraging social media, but doing it in ways that help us promote our brand and our identity, but it still fit with our purpose.
That's great. I think there are two ways that social media is essential for pretty much any brand now. One is customer support. Just earlier this week, we had a problem with our rental car, and literally the first thing we thought to do was tweet. Like, we didn't think to call a customer service number or go to a website. I was like, let's tweet about it. And I was like, what am I doing? But that's the reality of the world we live in now, that consumers expect that they're going to reach you on social media and that you're going to be available. The Red Cross actually put out a stat that said 80% of teenagers today believe that if they like put a Facebook status out, an ambulance will come to help them if they're in trouble just by a Facebook status, that they don't have to call 911. We still advocate calling 911, by the way. So that's a really interesting world. You need to understand that your consumers are going to come to you on social media for customer support.
We've done that as well. So we've actually found out about problems through social media and started to react to them before we would have found out through our normal channels.
And I think that's another great point too, because I think a lot of brands are really afraid of people who have negative things to say on social media. And some of those people are truly just trolls. Like, they'll never be happy no matter what. But occasionally you have someone who's reaching out because they do have a problem, and just engaging with them will turn them to a really passionate user. So I just, on a whim the other day, I was like looking, and of course, you know, there's always kind of mean hating people online. And one of the people who said, like, at Randy Zuckerberg, you're the worst person in the world. And I was like, well, I think that maybe I'm not so great today, but I think there's probably a few worse people. And so I tweeted back at him, and I was just like, oh, I'm so sorry you think that. I was going to, like, send you a book for your children for the holidays. And then he immediately texted me back and was like, oh, I would love that, and has literally written, like, 8 nice blog posts about my book since then. So sometimes people just, you know, really want to be engaged with. I think... Sorry, am I talking too much?
No.
Oh my gosh. The other thing that I think is really great for social media is that we're all content companies now. As much as you want to believe it or not, we're all media content companies. And so you have to think, you know, I'm not just selling a product or a service anymore. I also now have to entertain all of, whether you have 4 Twitter followers or 4 million, you have to think about content that you're putting out too.
So I'm going to switch a little bit to how do you create and develop a brand? Because I think a lot of our audience are entrepreneurs. They're sort of developing their brands. One of the things I've learned over time is that, you know, managing a great brand, working for a great brand, like Nike, a lot of the principles are the same. Doesn't sound like an ocean behind us or something. a lot of the principles are the same, right? So big versus small, there are so many commonalities. So I'm going to ask you the question. So when you're creating and developing a brand, which tools do you find to be the most useful? Mm-hmm. And what do you find to be the most detrimental? So if we're creating the brand of Xerox or the brand of Tracy or, you know, an individual company.
So the way that we begin, and we just redid an evolution of our brand, is we kind of go back to our purpose. What do we stand for? Mm-hmm. And what's our personality? So if you kind of have that in mind and you develop that brand purpose, that promise, that personality, and then from there look at, okay, how do I want my brand to look? How do I want my brand to sound? Then you can make sure that it always ties back to that personality, that foundation. And then it'll make sense, and it'll always be true, and it'll always feel right. A lot of what we do, and my team actually reviews about 400 pieces of branded communications on a monthly basis, so we just get everything from everywhere. A lot of it, when you look at it and you go, oh, that's way off brand, it's because it's over here. It sounds like Facebook talking, or it sounds like Nike talking. It doesn't sound like Xerox. Mm-hmm. And so make sure it's true to what your brand is, and then it makes total sense. And what I would say is, you know, from a big company like us, and you say, oh, brand police, right? That's what you hear when you think about brand. You know, that's the hard part. That's one of the tools that I'd say, oh, you know, how do you shed that image of brand police and come at it more from a, how do we create advocacy? How do we get everyone to believe in that brand promise? And then from there, you know, if they believe it, they understand it, they know it, they say it when you ask them in the elevator, what does Xerox stand for? Then chances are, when they put it on a piece of paper or a marketing material, it's going to be right.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think the one thing I would add is that design is really, really important. I don't think it, maybe 5-10 years ago, wasn't the number one thing I would tell people for branding, but people now have an expectation of a certain level of quality of design so that they, so it's sort of like, you know, when you always give advice, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. It's like your website should reflect that also. And I learned that really on. I was, you know, I spent some time early at Facebook a little aggravated by how much time the designers would spend going back and forth on rounded corners or, you know, little things like that. But it makes a huge difference to have a beautiful, beautiful design.
And I would say from a personal brand perspective, you know, like you said, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. You have a visual brand and a reputation brand that you carry around with you every day. When I started at Xerox, I was actually in engineering. And, you know, you come into engineering and it's all men and they all dress horrible. And so what I did is I always made sure that I dressed like a professional, looked like a professional, talked like a professional. And from a reputation standpoint, you always worked hard and delivered what you said you were going to do.
Yeah.
And it makes a huge difference.
It does. Actually, so for the last 100 straight days, I've worn only polka dots because of my books, Dot and Dot Complicated. And
so
talking about branding.
Yourself.
And so now, if I show up at an event in Silicon Valley, other people will wear polka dots, like because they are like, oh, like Randy's going to come wearing polka dots. We have to also. So even like silly things like that, you can brand yourself. And I see a lot of like cool polka dot dresses in the audience, so really good. So even like just think about little ways that you can stand out or brand yourself too.
Well, you know, it just reminds me of the point that we all want to do so much, and there are so many possibilities. You know, sometimes at Nike, we always said you have to edit to amplify. Mm-hmm. So you have to do more with less to kind of create that image. And I think even when you're a small brand and you're running your own business, you have to decide. You know, I always tell people, figure out what your mad skill is. Yeah. Figure out what you're amazingly good at and amplify that. First, you know, we all want to do everything well, but
it's very freeing because I used to go into my closet in the morning and just have so much clutter and so many things. And when I was like, I'm only going to wear polka dots, that it was just like freed up my mind for so many other creative things. Yeah. So simplify.
So I'm going to go ahead and open the floor up to some questions. And I hope if you jotted yours down, if you would go to the mics and we'll just get the conversation started and going. Don't be shy. And
Yay.
Yeah.
All right. So exciting.
So let's start over here.
Great. Thank you, guys. My name is Vicky, and I live here in Austin. I'm an entrepreneur, and I teach technology classes, specifically social media privacy. And this has to do with your picture at Christmas time. Do you remember that big thing, fiasco?
Oh, my God, that was ridiculous.
And you can share the story, the quick story. But my main concern, or when I talk to my audience, is, you know, as an entrepreneur, we want to be transparent and relevant to our audience and customers, having a personal brand and business brand. So I'm not, you know, I do public posts on Facebook, but the concern is balancing the privacy of our Christmas photos with our kids and our family and our business, you know, dealing. So what have you learned from that? What advice do you have that you want to share?
Gosh, so there is, I talk about this a lot in my book, so I won't go into the gory details. But my first general rule is that I don't post anything online unless I would be comfortable with it, like going on CNN or something. So I think that's a general rule that all of us, if you're talking to your children about Snapchat, things like that, like it's very easy to screenshot something. So nothing is you know, totally one-to-one on the internet. So last year at Christmas, I just like took a really funny photo of my family because everyone was on their phones around the kitchen table, and I was like, oh, how hilarious this is. Like, no one's even talking to each other. Everyone's on their phone. And I just took a picture, posted it to friends only, and then like later that night, I saw it was on a bunch of blogs. And I was like, how did that get on a bunch of blogs? I posted it to friends only, and well, someone who was not so much of a friend, I guess, had like screenshotted or downloaded it and sent it to a bunch of blogs. And that was a real, I think, wake-up call for me in the fact that in real life, there are three kinds of sharing that we do. There's like super private sharing. There's super public sharing. But most of our lives is in the middle, which I call personal sharing. Like stuff that, you know, we might talk about backstage, and it's not private, but it's not public. But online, you don't get that anymore. Personal information is gone. You only have private and public. And what does that mean for us when in real life we live so much of our lives in the middle? So that's sort of what I write about in Dot Complicated.
Next.
Well, Randy, you talked about changing the world through Facebook. And I was at a meeting last week with a group of women, and we were discussing getting Wendy Davis elected as governor.
Awesome.
And
she's so cool.
One of the problems is the men have all decided that there's no way she can be elected because they have more money. And I said, we have something they don't. We talk and we connect. So we were discussing the fact that you would be here, and I said, I'm just going to go straight to the source and ask her, we would like to, if 10% more women would vote in Texas, she would win.
Wow.
The voting rate is very, very low in this state and very low in the United States. So my question to you is, how do we get women to commit through Facebook, A, that they will sign up, register to vote, and B, that they will vote?
It's interesting. Actually, in the past elections we've seen, you know, on television there's all these PSAs like vote or die and go vote. But when you actually see a friend say, like, I just went to the voting polls, it makes you, I think, like 25% more likely to go vote. So one thing that I implemented while I was at Facebook that is still going on is every state, every country that's having an election will get a big banner at the top of their homepage on the day that says, like, today is voting day, go vote. And if you click you voted, it message tells all of your friends, like, Randy Zuckerberg just voted, because that seems to be one of the biggest things, the social pressure that people feel like they don't want to be the one person of their friends who didn't vote. So I would just encourage people to, like, share that you voted with as many people as possible and get the word out that way, because that seems to be, like, the biggest thing that makes an impact.
One last question. Would it help to have a page that where people could go on Facebook and say, I promise that I'm registered to vote and I will vote and I'll ask 10 of my friends to vote?
Absolutely.
And list the friends?
Steph, there's a lot, like change.org and a lot of sites like that are really great.
Or just start a page like that?
Yeah, you could start a page or tap into one of those sites that use Facebook login in order to blast the word out. But yes, so
perfect.
I think that would be really exciting.
Thank you. We do too.
I'm not an expert at this, but I lived in Oregon for 13 years, and I know their vote by mail was also an incredible reason why there's such great voter turnout in the state of Oregon as well. So I think it's that modern versus traditional as well. What's the balance? Next.
I also think getting the word out of what you just told me, like, that makes me angry that they feel that way, that, like, men feel that way. So, like, getting that word out, I think, like, nothing mobilizes women better than that.
So I think we have polka dots over here, right?
Hi.
Yeah.
So my question is kind of in general for different businesses. When you're starting a brand and you're starting to build your website, what is, in your opinion, you know, what's one thing that makes it look professional and one thing that makes it look like a safe place to be, just in general?
So I'll start.
Yeah,
great. I think one thing that makes it look professional is professional design. So Randy talked about this earlier, and Karen's an industrial designer. I think when you look at websites, and you can go off and look at lots of different websites, you can tell the ones that have great design and the ones that were not necessarily well designed. So that's, I think, the number one thing that you've got to look at. And then you want them to again, reflect your brand purpose, your promise. So you want it to be inviting. You want it to be easy to find information. And then, you know, whatever it is that's your key thing that you're selling or doing, make sure that that's kind of front and center. So that would be my advice.
I would say also, if you're starting your own thing, you could use a trusted platform that already exists. So instead of creating your own whole site to sell something, you know, use Etsy or use Shopify. Like, use those sites that people already are there, they're already trusting. So even though you're a brand new seller on those platforms, people
That's
will.
A good idea.
And then I also think, like, getting as many reviews as you can, you know, whether it's you're an author or you're an eBay seller or anything that you're doing, the more reviews that you get, people seem to really put a lot of emphasis in online reviews.
And understanding the soul of your company too, right? Because you can get the functionality and the performance out of the website that you want, but what's going to be unique to you is the soul. And, you know, working with a great designer, even if it's a graphic design student at a local university, right, they'll be able to almost be an anthropologist for your brand and really start to surface all of what's meaningful and unique. So.
There's a site I love. It's called 99 Designs. And instead of hiring, like, a fancy, expensive design firm, you can actually go on and say, I want a logo, here are the colors and stuff I want, and I'm going to give $300 to the best one I get. And then you get dozens of submissions. So crowdsourcing design is a really affordable way to go also.
Okay, how about here?
Hey, for startups who have limited budgets, as far as, like, marketing, what do you think are the best places to, you know, place your resources? Or people who have, like, a limited amount of employees, you know, and there's just so much, there's so many tweets and Facebook posts, and how do you get people's attention, you know?
I'll start, and then you can chime in. It depends on the business that you're in. So it depends on who your consumers are and where they're most likely to frequent. So if your customers and consumers are going to be on Facebook, then I would place some bets on Facebook and put a resource. It's not expensive to put a Facebook page up for your business. What it takes is a resource, though. It takes somebody that's watching it and monitoring it, adding content, adding posts. Same thing with a blog or Twitter, any of those types of things. It doesn't take a lot of money to actually set them up. What it takes is somebody that's going to actually monitor and think up good content and make sure that that's getting placed on there. But the other thing is make sure you understand who your audience is, because if your audience isn't on social or they're only looking at blogs or they're only looking at, you know, this, you know, one of our audiences wasn't a big Facebook audience, and therefore we didn't have a Facebook page for that specific audience. So it depends on who your audience is, you know, and where you place your bets.
I'd also say if you can encourage your most passionate consumers to do free marketing for you, like Stella and Dot is a great example of this. They had they have 3,000 stylists around the country who aren't paid by Stella and Dot, but they go out and they hold trunk shows, and now Stella and Dot has gotten their brand everywhere for very low upfront marketing cost. So if you think of, like, who are, even if you only have 4 or 5 really passionate users to start with, like, how do you get those people to amplify the message?
And just to kind of build on that, but in a little bit different vein, you talked about Etsy earlier. One of the things that we've done, or that I've done from a consumer standpoint, is it depends on the response you get. So if I can get immediate response from a company, I'm going to be much more likely to do business with them than I am from a company who, you know, you send in a question or a query and you get a response 2 days later. You know, the guy that responded to me in, you know, 3 minutes or 10 minutes is going to get my business.
Thank you. How about here?
When it comes to ideas on products and how you want to get that idea out of your head, be competitive within the new market, and be something different and innovative, what would be a good suggestion or advice on how you can get that idea and turn that into a brand, a marketable brand, and something that's new?
So I think a lot of it is around what is the value that that brings, what's the benefit that that brings to the end user. So a lot of times you'll see things and you're like, wow, that's a really great idea, but it has a horrible name. Or, you know, you don't really understand what it does for that end user, for that person. And so it's about what's the value, what's the benefit, and then how do you communicate that in really simple language? And then you can get that out in whatever channel best suits that market.
That's a great answer.
How about over here?
Hi. My question is about carpets. How do you go about branding a product that has always been in the market but has been underpriced because the way it's made? Growing up, I made carpets. Now I'm a software programmer at Rackspace. I'm from Afghanistan, and I know how carpets are made. When I go to a store, it's very, very underpriced for what the person went through to make that carpet. But then there is carpets that were not made by hand and just look like the one that were made by hand, and are, because of those carpets, maybe the handmaids are just because they were made overseas and people didn't realize how they were made and they're not branded correctly. I think they have done a great job in the coffee market where they've branded coffee and trading it fairly. So, I mean, I've been trying to brainstorm for like over a couple of years how to brand and raise awareness for people and make them to pay the price that's right for the product. And how to,
what is your advice? There's actually a cool guy in Silicon Valley who I was having this exact question, and he actually decided he was going to invite, like, make a startup incubator inside his carpet store. And so he actually invited like several like high profile new startups and said, like, I'm actually going to give you the seed funding for your startup, but you're going to work here, you're going to take all your meetings here in my carpet store, like, we're going to have events here. And he's now actually heralded as like one of the most innovative seed funders in Silicon Valley, but everything is done in his carpet store, and when people come in, then he also like takes it as an opportunity to educate people about where the things are made and the materials, and everyone gets tea, and it's just like a whole thing. And through him, I've actually learned more than I ever knew. So I thought that was like a pretty cool thing that he does.
Absolutely.
I also think it's a good idea to look at other industries that have gone through a similar challenge. You know, I think even the fashion industry has started to go through the, you know, we're returning more to an appreciation for artisan and bespoke and craftsmanship. And whether you look at the industry of glass, or if you even look at Savile Row suits, you know, I think finding those analogous industries and, you know, understanding now that there's a desire for more transparency, right? People are open for stories again, you know, even though we're moving very, very fast, we're opening for stories. So how do you tell the great story that will connect to the heart and mind? So.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, I'm with Girl Scouts of Central Texas, and we're a pretty well-known brand, and we've been around for over 100 years now. And the challenge that we're facing right now is that we're a pretty classic brand. I mean, we're known all over the country and even all over the world. But we cater to a pretty large spectrum, generational spectrum. We cater to girls. We cater to their parents and a lot of older members as well that volunteer to serve several functions with us. So our challenge right now is changing our perception, you know, from a classic brand, and we're usually associated with cookies, but we do so much more. You know,
they're really delicious cookies.
They are amazing. I'm not going to deny that they're the best. But you know, even the cookies, they do so much more for girls, and we have so many programs. But how do we engage this large base of people that we serve, and how do we modernize the perception of our brand, which, you know, like I said, people usually think cookies. How do we tell them we do a lot more, and how do we make sure that every part of the people that we serve is engaged with this new change?
Yeah, so I think my daughter is a Girl Scout, and I think it's important to kind of go back and think about what do we stand for as Girl Scouts, and then from there, what are the things that we really want to get across? And then how do you take the Girl Scout crest or the emblem in your brand and then evolve it in a way that makes people think that it's fresher, that it has more to offer? And then what are the things that you can talk about in that same light so that people say, oh, I didn't know that Girl Scouts did that? And then what are the outlets that you can use? You have your website, which is mostly focused on, you know, downloading a healthcare form or whatever that you need for your Girl Scout. But are there other means of, you know, can you start and maybe you have Twitter, but can you start some social media outlets? Maybe there's a, you know, you have a lot of social programs. So maybe there's a little bit of a social area on your website that you can talk about some stories of how you've done success, you know, had success with areas of improvement. But I think that there's a lot of ways that Girl Scouts can talk about the great things you've done that go beyond where you are today and maybe evolving your brand at the same time. So people look at it and go, oh, there's a new reason to look at Girl Scouts.
It's a bit of what you discussed at Xerox about leveraging legacy.
Right.
Definitely. I think also highlighting some of the innovative things that are going on. Like, I remember I was so impressed when one year at Facebook, someone's daughter came in and was, like, talking to everyone about cookies. And everyone's like, oh, I don't have my wallet. And she's like, no, that's okay. I take PayPal. Like, I take PayPal, and like and she sold so many cookies, and I was so impressed. I actually ended up pitching a story to a bunch of the tech blogs, like, to highlight this girl who I thought was so innovative. And so I think doing more things like positioning yourselves as a leader in, like, STEM education and entrepreneurship for young girls is a story that no one's really telling about the Girl Scouts, but something you guys are already doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi.
Okay.
Okay. My name is Lisa, and I own the Sojourner Tour Company. So we take culinary tours to France. Mm-hmm. And we have a really wide audience, age-wise, but we're having trouble getting our brand or our message developed to people who are not in the 20 to 40 age group, because we've been using mainly the social media. And I was wondering if you could give me some tips, because we'd like to kind of branch out into people who are over 40 as well. How do I get our brand out to those people?
Go ahead, go ahead. So, you know, short of social media, I mean, there are a lot of traditional tactics that will help. You know, if you think about the older generation, some of them are on social media, like my mom, who's 75, but some are not. And so, you know, have you thought about maybe a targeted direct mail campaign that's using one-to-one variable data communications, so that you can think about, okay, if we're going to France and they subscribe to Food and Wine magazine, I'm making things up here, but, you know, those are the kinds of things, maybe buying some lists like that where people may be interested might be a good way to get started. Go ahead.
Well, I had considered that, but someone told me that the actual response, or I'm not sure exactly what you call it when someone actually reacts,
response, right? Yep.
Is not very good for those sort of targeted mail campaigns.
It depends on the creative, and it depends on the campaign. You know, on a typical spray and pray direct mail campaign, you're going to get maybe 0.5%. On a targeted direct mail campaign, you can get upwards of 5 or 8%, depending on the audience, depending on your list. You can also utilize some greater targeting methods within that campaign, so that it's addressed to, you know, Bob and Sally, you know, and trying to find some additional information that'll allow it to get a greater response rate. So there are some opportunities like that. You might also try to target some travel companies. I don't know if you work with those, but I know a lot of the travel companies target, you know, the older generation, because they do travel a lot more. And so if you can tap into those, there might be an opportunity there as well, again, with targeted direct mail.
Thanks.
Although I also say, don't count social media out. I mean, even 2 years ago when I was in my final year at Facebook, women 50 plus were the fastest growing in signing up for the site. And I mean, that was 2 years ago. So I think that you may have to change the way that you word things or message things. But I think a lot of your audience you want to reach are on those sites you're already working on.
Thank you. Super.
Hi there. My name is Karina Franke. I own a company called Competitive Creations. And my question has to do with name changes. And I think, Tracy, you might be able to help me with this, because Xerox has that sort of Kleenex tissue sort of thing going on. Years ago, when I decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur, I thought I had the perfect name. I wanted to name my business Competitive Creations without knowing nothing about the business. And I know now that that was part a bad branding technique. And now that I'm 4 years into my business and it's growing rapidly, people call my business Creative Creations. They don't get it. I hire promotional models for Living Street Teams, ambassadors, et cetera. And at this point, I don't know if it's more of a relational thing, because my business is word of mouth, and maybe it's me that they recognize my business, or I don't know what it is, and I don't know if I should change the name or not.
Well, hard to answer that one on the spot.
Fair enough.
But I think, you know, a lot goes into a name, but a lot of times it's the recognition that gets attached to that name as well. And so once you start to gain that recognition, then you do have a dilemma on your hands on, do I change the name or do I not change the name?
My clients love calling us Creative Creations, but it's just not the name.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well,
there's actually a catering company in town. They're pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Creative Creations.
Now, what's the name of your company again?
Competitive Creations.
Competitive.
And in fact, our branding technique was to call the girls Competitive Chicks, and that has caught on.
Okay.
And therefore, they want to hire Competitive Chicks. They just don't know how to call Competitive Creations.
Yeah.
So I'm having this dilemma with, should I change my name?
Calling it Competitive Chicks. company or something.
I think like that's just kind of weird. Yeah.
What about using your name as like the name of the company?
I want to grow and scale. You know, we've been pretty successful in Texas and in California, and I want to grow as a national staffing agency.
So, I mean, what I would do and what we typically do from a naming perspective is we look at, you know, this is really brand speak, but it's, you know, what are the 3 to 5 most important attributes that you want that name to convey? When you think about what that name says, what is it that you want people to take away instantly? And do they get that from competitive creations, or do they get that from something that's more specific to what it is that you really offer? And then you do some pros and cons, and you say, okay, do I change my name because it'll be more indicative of what we deliver and people will remember it? And therefore, you know, and you can get creative with that, you know, and just make sure you do a search. You know, a trademark search, so you're not infringing on anyone, because the last thing you want to have to do is change your name again.
Fair enough.
And maybe even just consider buying all the domains for Creative Creations also and have it redirect to you, just if people are already searching that, make sure they find you.
Yep. Okay.
I think when you said it too, for me, I teach a class in innovation, and I always tell people, you know, when you go out and do research or talk to people, don't accept their first response. But I also say don't accept your first idea, right? Sometimes we fall in love with our first ideas. And, you know, sometimes you have to think bigger, even if you're small, right? Think about the place you want to be versus where you are.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Do we have time for a couple more? Okay.
Hi, I'm Shantae Taylor, and I'm at the beginning stages of branding myself using my own name. And I actually teach people how to use the greatest technology they have, which is their brain, and how to have it empower them and be more productive and better leaders. And my question is, how do I dig into the psyche of my customer avatar? How do I find out if they're on Facebook or what websites they attend or what they really need and want so I can tailor my message to their needs?
Have you done much focus grouping?
No.
It's interesting. So I just put out my first official research report because I've been working on this dot complicated brand for a year and kind of assuming what people wanted, but really wanted to do a report. So we surveyed 4,000 women in US, UK, Brazil, and China about their mobile usage and their kits. And some of it was like very in line with what I thought, but some of it was really, really different. For example, only 45% of the women said they thought that the internet had made their life better. And that meant that 55% like did not think that the internet made their life better, which was like shocking and made me sad and it just made me rethink a lot of things.
Right.
And so then that really changed how I spoke to people through my newsletter and through a lot of things. So I think even, you know, not everyone can afford to do like a full-on research or focus group, but even making sure you're gathering groups of women and just asking them questions and listening, I think a lot of us talk and very few of us listen.
Yeah. Yes. Very true.
That's a good point.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Okay, let's do this one and then
My name is Cindy Foreman and I own a company called Embellish My Wedding, and it's an online store that sells wedding and party stuff. So since we're all online, I've been trying to brainstorm ways to kind of grow our social media presence. And in the wedding industry, everyone likes to share pictures, you know, of ideas and stuff that they did. So we've been trying on Facebook and Twitter to kind of send the word out there to the followers we already have, you know, share your stories and kind of start to engage the customers like you were saying. And I've even sent out emails to, you know, previous customers, you know, to post stuff. But it's kind of a hard struggle to get it started. Because we tweet stuff out, but nobody, you know, is tweeting us and Facebooking us. So do you have any suggestions of how to kind of get that initial? I think once it starts, people are going to comment on it, and then it'll kind of kick off from there. But to get it started, how would you go about that?
Sorry, can you just remind me one more time what the exact business you're in?
It's an online store that does, like, wedding stuff and party stuff.
So I wonder if maybe there's other startups that are in, like, flowers or dresses or things like that that you could form like your own mini affiliate network with. So if you partner with other businesses, even if it's like DJ or different services, all in the kind of wedding sphere, and you all agree to promote one another or have like bulk discounts and things like that, that seems to be one of the things that works the best. I know a lot of YouTube stars do that. Like people just starting off on YouTube, they'll find like 12 other people who are doing the same sort of content and all agree to promote each other. So the same kind of thing must work in the blog and online business also.
One of the things that we did to get people to like us on Facebook and so to create greater buzz around our Facebook page was to create a contest. And so we would, you know, if you had somebody submit, they could, you know, on something that they've done, you could actually have them create a contest or voting, what do you like best, and, you know, it could be a prize of free stuff or, you know, just anything to create a buzz and get the interaction going, and then people can actually, it'll spin off from there. So.
Thank you. Thanks.
Last question.
Okay, I'll make this quick. I have a seemingly very boring business that I'm starting. It's tax. I love it. I think it's exciting, but nobody else does. And I have a very, very hard time reaching out to people via social media. The reason is my target audience are like young couples just getting married, buying their first houses, starting their first businesses. But you see like a post about somebody like, oh, these are the great deductions you could take. Everyone just skims over that. So how do I take a seemingly boring topic and make it eye-catching enough that people will click or look around?
I think one is hire a storyteller. You know, tell the story, follow them on their journey. You know, literally observe somebody on the journey, and you will get inspiration for when they are having moments of joy and moments of pain. Okay. And you can imagine that other people are having similar moments. I would say that.
Another thing you might think about is rather than it being, oh, here's all the deductions you could take, maybe you phrase it, you break it down, because a lot of times people can't digest all of those things all at once. But what we do, like if we're launching a new product, rather than sending out, here's everything you want to know about this great new product, a did you know? And every couple of days, we'll put out one little fact about this new product. And it becomes kind of a campaign or a series of, well, did you know that, you know, you can get a $100 deduction for this, or, you know, and a few days later, you know, hey, have, you know, your kids can do this, or just kind of, what are the ways you can do to kind of spread it out and put it in little bite-sized chunks?
Sorry, I'm like choking.
And in 140 here. Characters, too, yeah. Right?
Like, we have another suggestion over here.
Like photobomb?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like photobombing. This is what she would do. So it would be like, you know, when the government closed down, she had a little clip about that. So you actually read this newsletter, and apparently she doesn't write it. It comes from some service. Oh. But I don't care. It's got her picture on it. And she's funny. When she'll write like a little note after that. And I'm telling you, she's got probably, she said she inherited that, and she uses that newsletter. But it gets spread because it's something funny. I'm going to tell all of my friends, and maybe somebody there.
It's a great idea.
That's a good idea. Okay. Yep.
There's another one. Yeah, go ahead. So what we're going to do is Tracy and Randy will be up for a little while. And
I'm actually going to sign books.
Oh, you're
going
to go
sign books. So okay. Anyone, come meet me at the book signing table.
And just thank you so much. This was great. Really engaged. Thank you all for your questions.
Thank you.